In 2000, Zimbabwe's President Mugabe and his ZANU-PF party lost a constitutional referendum. They began a violent and chaotic land reform program where police, war veterans, and youth militia assaulted and evicted hundreds of thousands of Zimbabweans, black and white.
That is a clip from House of Justice, a documentary about the human rights violations happening in Zimbabwe following a government land reform project. Human rights hero Gertrude Hambura is a Zimbabwe union organizer turned filmmaker. Gertrude produced House of Justice in 2009, which documents human rights violations by the Zimbabwe government.
Okay, my name is Gertrude Hambura. I am a mother of five, four girls and one boy. And I'm here in Winnipeg with my husband, George, who is working as an industrial electrician.
The film caught the attention of government officials, and Gertrude was forced to leave her home to flee for her life. Gertrude now calls Winnipeg her home. I sat down with her to talk about what is happening back at home in Zimbabwe and how she rose to her position.
I have worked my entire life in the labor movement. I briefly worked for the clothing industry, and then later on I worked for the agriculture industry. This is where I grew. This is where my mom and father used to work, and I am a village girl who grew up in poverty, who did not have that opportunity to go to higher levels due to exploitations and the conditions in which we were living under. In the farms, we were living and working in the farms. I have gone through the phases of all labor activities in terms of working as a child laborer, working as a union organizer, and rising through the ranks until I got the position of the general secretary.
You say you grew up in poverty, but is that something that's regular for the population of Zimbabwe?
Oh, yeah. Well, Zimbabwe is a British colony, and when we were colonized, the first generation which was colonized, the white people, when they came into the country, they brought in people from neighboring countries to come and work for them. And as they settled in the land, they acquired very rich soil, which they used for agriculture purposes. And most of those who worked in the farms were those who migrated from Mozambique, Malawi, Zambia. And also the native people, due to lack of employment, also worked in the farms. I am a native. My parents did not migrate from the neighboring countries, but were born and bred up in Zimbabwe. By then it was called Rhodesia, before independence. And we attained our independence in 1980. So these are the people who worked in the farms, those who migrated from the neighboring countries. And these are the people who have not known of any other home than staying at the farm, being taken care of by the farmer. The schooling for the children was provided for. The health facilities were provided for by the farmer. So which meant that the farm workers lived a vicious circle. You are born and bred at the farm. You don't know what the outside world is like. And in terms of education, the children will go up to probably grade 2 or 3. And the teachers at the farms were actually provided by the farmer, probably those who were not really trained, but just to get the school going. And so that was it. And also, life in the farms was and is, as of today, not an easy road. Here, when you are at the farm, you are given a very big task to work on. And if you don't finish that task, you are not paid. And the parents are then forced to bring their children to come and help them in the field so that they are paid. So you find that a task which is supposed to be accomplished by an individual at the end of the day is accomplished by 5 to 6 people. And at the end of the day, only you get the wages of a single person. Mm-hmm. and that's really increases the rate of child labor. But when you are in it, you don't see it as a child labor because all you want is bread and butter on the table. And if you don't help your parents in the field, at the end of the day, there's no food for you. So you don't see it as child labor. But as you grow up into it, you then realize that something is wrong. Something has to be talked about. And yes, you start talking about it and you become unfavorable with the employers and other forces who are doing the same.
So now, what did the government try to do in 2000 to change the situation? Or did it work like that?
In fact, like I say, having grown in the labor movement and in Zimbabwe, we used to be under a one-party state for a long, long time. We never had any opposition party in terms of political structure. So we used to be under one regime. And when things started going haywire, there was lots of corruption, lots of bad governance, and there was really a fall in healthy delivery, basic delivery services. And there was lots of pressure by the working class to say, I think something needs to be done. The National Center, which is the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Union, needs to speak out for the people. And there was a lot of pressure from the working class that the National Center, which was the voice of the voiceless, should form a political party, which was then formed, the MDC, or Movement of Democratic Change, to challenge the bad governance of the current regime. So that did not go well with the Mugabe regime. Yes, that is the time when this new political party was born out of a labor movement, which he had very, very strong affiliations. And then in supporting that labor movement, the farmers also supported that labor movement, and the government said, oh, okay, you are supporting the opposition. We are now going to confiscate land from you. But even before that, there was a land reform program, land resettlement program, where the government was getting compensation from the United Kingdom and compensating the farmers who were willing to hand over their farms. And that went on well. But that same compensation, some of it was not used to the beneficiaries of the Zimbabweans. It was actually pocketed. That is when the Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions leadership started to say, well, this is wrong. If you are doing that, you are getting money and you are not using it to develop the country or to resettle the landless. So one of the policies which was in line for the new party, for the MDC, was lend to the landless. And also my organization, as an organization which represented the landless people, we had already started advocating when our organization was conceived for lend to the landless, because we regarded ourselves as the landless. We migrated from neighboring countries and we had not known of any other home apart from being attached to the employer, attached to the farmer. Yes, if you lose your employment today, you have lost your entire livelihood. You have to move to the next farm to look for employment, get your children into school and everything. You have to start afresh. So we're saying lend to the landless, lend to the landless. And then the government was saying, oh, okay, now you have a new party which is saying lend to the landless. We are going to take over that policy. And for them, it was not lend to the landless, because here now we had a situation whereby they were now taking land from the white minority. There was nothing wrong. Everybody really wanted that imbalance to be corrected. But now we had a situation where there was a forcible grabbing of land from the white commercial farmers. And these are the rich white commercial farmers, giving it to the black rich people, those who hold political positions. Those are the ones who were given that land. Those who don't have, the landless did not benefit.
In Chegutu alone, there have been 10,000 people affected by this violence in the last few months. But Chegutu is only one district. Across the country, 1.9 million farm workers and their families have been in this situation since land reform began. About 15% of Zimbabwe's population lived and worked on the farms. 71% of farm workers have been evicted and are living on handouts from donor agencies. This is the story of just three of the farms that have come under attack in the last 12 months, and the farmers and the farm workers whose livelihoods have been destroyed. It is also the story of their attempts to use the regional court, the SADC tribunal, to achieve justice.
Focused on three farmers. Is that story not uncommon?
Why if we focused on those, it was not an easy road, the land issue in Zimbabwe, because Mugabe said there's no going back to the land. In terms of the land reform program, we are taking what belongs to us and distributing it amongst every son and daughter of the soil, as they say. But if the landless, the people whom I represented, had benefited, I guess all those violations would have not happened. Here we have a leader who would go to the United Nations and say that we are not violating human rights, but we are correcting the imbalances. And here you are sitting here in Canada. You don't know what is happening on the ground. Someone has to tell it. Someone has to show it. Given the opportunity, my organization would have gone throughout the country getting such images, because this was happening throughout the country, not on those particular farms. The reason for focusing on those particular farms, you know, that some of these farms, there were agreements between country and country or region to region that these are not going to be confiscated, and because they are producing for the entire country. I mean, they are producing for the entire region. They are producing for the entire continent. I know once upon a time we used to be the breadbasket of Africa. We are no more right now. So the reason why my organization went underground and produced that that documentary was to show the world that this is what is happening. When that was happening, we did not have independent media to show. CNN, BBC, and other independent media were actually banned in the country. It is now when the civic society is actually fighting for reforms to say that these things need to be told. If ever there's BBC right now in the country, it means that they've sneaked into the country unknown. They are not allowed. But nevertheless, we had to tell the story of what is happening to the country to say that it's not about black and white, but it's about human rights violations. Both the blacks and the whites were actually affected by that issue.
Clearly. Mm-hmm. So what kind of risks did you take yourself in making that film?
My life has always been at risk, even before the land seizure, because here we have white commercial farmers who did not want their workers to be unionized. We had served in the Smith regime. Each time we went to the farms to unionize the workers, some of them will set dogs on us. They will point guns at us to say, this is a private property. They will threaten the workers to say, if you join the union, you will go with Gertrude. If you don't join the union, you will stay here at the farm and I will take care of you. And that means increasing the rate of exploitation. That means zipping the mouth of that worker, of those workers who would want to say, our working conditions are very poor, our wages are very poor, you don't have anywhere to talk to, you don't have anywhere who would speak on your behalf. So getting farm workers into the union has been a very long process before independence. I mean, soon after independence, and even as we speak today. So what we did, being a community woman, a village girl, we just went out into the community, because in terms of mobilizing workers, we used to stay there in the community, get information. And if you were going to come where we were having our programs in the farms, you wouldn't actually notice me because I would be just like any other village woman. And because we wanted this to be known, we also used our mobile phones to take those footages because we did not have these sophisticated cameras and everything. We were just taking those footings using our mobile phones where we could, especially when we interviewed the farmers, that is where we would use them. Better cameras, but otherwise it was just done in a layman's setup.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And when was a lot of that taken? I guess it would have been 2008 and 2009.
But before that, I think if you go on Google, the independent media, when the seizure started in 2000, you will see farms being burned down. You will see farm workers being thrown off the farms. You will see lots and lots of information. But the period that was done, that is the same period when we had now an inclusive government between the MDC and the ZANU-PF, and we really wanted to engage to say that now we have a new structure in place. Can you please bring this to an end? And they said, well, there's nothing which is happening. And we said, do you want evidence? Do you want the truth? This is the truth. This is happening. Little did I know that the truth will land me in Winnipeg.
Where does SADC or SADC?
Like in any given situation or region, SADC is a community of all countries in the Southern Africa. It oversees political issues within the region. I think it's made out of 13, 16 countries. I can't remember very well. And also, along SADC, in terms of the trade union structure, we have what is called the SATUC, Southern African Trade Union Council. So whenever you have a grievance, you take it to SADC. And then the SADC proceeds over that grievance and make a judgment. Whereas as trade unionists, if ever we have a grievance, we also take it to SATUC. So the farmers took their case to SADC to say, this is what is happening to us. And the SADC, which is made out of all those Southern African countries, he has judges sitting in a tribunal. And they ruled that the government was not supposed to take land in such a manner. And Mugabe, being himself, did not respect that ruling.
Right.
And the seizures continued.
Now, are SADC respected and listened to in the other Southern African countries? Do you know?
The like case of Zimbabwe has been the first of its kind, which has been brought before the SADC tribunal. This is the first time I've heard. But in terms of probably standing for each other, the leadership, they do stand for each other. That's why they have not been able to tell Mugabe that he has to stop human rights violations. Because I remember at one time when Mugabe was at the AU, African Union, he actually said, and I quote, if there's any African leader here with a clean finger, let him dare point it at me. And none of them, which means that they are brothers in terms of supporting each other. So it's really, really, it then becomes very, very difficult for the ordinary person.
Right. Mm-hmm. So the line between a farm worker and a politician is huge.
It's very, very, very huge. Like right now, they have taken over the land, and we were expecting things to be better off. But Right. Here now we have a new breed of black farmers who say to their workers, you made the white people rich. Now it's my turn. And they have to work. They don't get good salaries. I remember when I was still in the country back home, we used to fight on backlogs. They will be 6 months behind in terms of paying their salaries. And when I left, by then the minimum wage was around $20. And I hear now it's around $50 a month. and this is supposed to send your children to school. This is supposed to take care of you when you get sick. HIV, AIDS, drugs, they are very expensive. This is supposed to clothe you. This is supposed to transport you to from point A to point B, $50 a month. So, which means that this situation then forces the farm worker to say, education is not a priority. I have to buy the basics for the children so that they can eat. And some of these children, HIV, AIDS, have not spared their parents. We now have children who are heading families because their parents have died. We have lots of orphans heading a household back home.
James and Kerry Etheridge were assaulted in the presence of armed police officers who stood by and did nothing.
Military, veterans, and police, do they get paid better than the average farmer? Is that why they aren't speaking out? Or what puts them in a position to carry out those violations?
Oh, well, the political elite, I guess, Zimbabwe is rich in minerals. A couple of years ago, they actually discovered a field of diamonds, which they have now owned themselves. Rather than channeling resources from those diamonds to develop the community, they are not doing that. And I would say some of the farm workers who lost employment actually went to those fields to dig up gold. But eventually that place was actually, they sent soldiers to drive people away, and they will say that this section would belong to this minister. This section, it's now belong to the political elite. The soldiers, I wouldn't say they are paid very well. Everybody's just scared. Yeah. It's really, really scared. You know, we got our independence through the liberation struggle, and there was a lot of blood was spilled, and people don't want that situation again. We rather resolve this conflict in an nonviolent conflict, because each time you try to raise your hand or to open your mouth, you will be told that this country was won not by the barrel of the pen, but by the barrel of the gun. And that is very strong to silence you. I remember myself when we used to go for negotiations, some of these farmers, new farmers, would just take a gun and put it on the table, which means that, what do I say? Oh, someone just pet his jacket to show me that whatever I want to say, I must make know that I'm speaking to a high-profile person in terms of his or her political position. So it's very, they are not paid. People are just scared right now for their life.
That was part one of a two-part interview with Gertrude Hambura. You can catch part two next week. If you'd like to check out the film House of Justice, you can find it in three parts on YouTube.